This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and guests about politics. It's Thursday, December 3rd. I'm Dorothy Wickenden, executive editor of The New Yorker.
From this day forward, a new vision will govern our land. From this day forward, it's going to be only America first. America first.
In Trump's inaugural address 4 years ago, he set the stage for his administration's foreign policy. In the interest of putting America first, Trump has gutted the State Department, withdrawn the country from key treaties and accords, alienated traditional allies, expressed admiration for authoritarians around the world, and escalated tensions in Iran, Afghanistan, and elsewhere. President-elect Biden has sworn to unravel Trump's America First foreign policy and to work to rebuild the United States' reputation abroad. Biden has announced several key foreign policy and national security appointments, and at a press conference last week, he emphasized that he's assembling a team he expects to restore a spirit of international engagement.
It's a team that will keep our country and our people safe and secure. It's a team that reflects the fact that America is back, ready to lead the world, not retreat from it, once again sit at the head of the table, ready to confront our adversaries and not reject our allies, ready to stand up for our values. In fact, in calls from world leaders that I've had, about 18 of them or 20 so far, I'm not sure the exact number, in the week since we won the election, I've been struck by how much they're looking forward to the United States reasserting its historic role as a global leader.
Susan Glasser, a New Yorker staff writer, joins me to discuss the Biden administration's foreign policy plans and whether it's possible to resuscitate America's reputation abroad. Susan, always so good to have you on the program.
Oh, great to be with you, Dorothy.
The Trump administration had that snappy slogan for its foreign policy, America First, but his actual policy positions abroad, as at home, were chaotic. He was hawkish in some places, isolationist in others, sometimes antagonistic to foreign leaders, sometimes shockingly deferential. Looking back now, is there a through line of Trump's foreign policy?
Well, look, the shorthand critique, right, Dorothy, is America First was actually America alone. And I do think a sort of aggressive unilateralism really characterizes certainly Trump's preferred approach, not only to the world, but more or less to anything. It's my way or, you know, the highway. And that, I think, is the explanation for the otherwise inexplicable, at times, constant rhetoric, treating America's allies as if they were adversaries, while sort of inexplicably praising adversaries and looking up to admiring authoritarians around the world. So in Western Europe right now, America and Donald Trump are less popular, less respected than Xi Jinping of China, than Vladimir Putin of Russia. Now, you know, it's like when Obama came in, you know, Biden is going to be able to be more popular. But the question about how and if you can reverse some of the damage, can you really have a restorationist foreign policy? That is a much harder, I think, question to answer.
You've written over the years about Trump's lack of popularity internationally. So even the authoritarian leaders he desperately courted did not go out of their way to show their respect for him. And in one of your pieces, you wrote about, well, let's say his fraught relationship with Angela Merkel of Germany. And everyone remembers the video that leaked last year of Francis Emmanuel Macron, Canada's Justin Trudeau, and the UK's Boris Johnson seeming to crack jokes at the president's expense. What has been the reaction among foreign leaders to Biden's victory?
Well, look, one striking thing you have to say about the few weeks since the U.S. election is that foreign leaders, both authoritarians and Western allies, have been quicker to embrace the results of the election and Biden's victory than Republican members of the Senate. It's pretty incredible. In fact, right now, Vladimir Putin appears to be essentially the lone holdout, at least among the world's major powers. However, you know, nice words in diplomacy are let's just say, an easy commodity. They are in great supply. What's not clear is, you know, what is the credibility that the U.S. has remaining in the world? Because that's the other aspect of diplomacy is, you know, the credibility of a nation is important when considering whether to make a deal with it. And I think one of the biggest challenges that Biden faces is a new recognition on the part of many other leaders and countries in the world that the U.S. may not be good at its word. What's the point of making a new Iran deal if another U.S. administration may just come in a few years and undo it immediately? And so I think that is probably the biggest challenge that Biden faces.
Yeah, and we'll get to that in a second. But what you're saying is that you can't just flip a switch. Biden's campaign theme essentially was return to normalcy. He claims now that America's back. And, you know, when he was vice president, he and Obama didn't always agree. But we saw in last week's diplomatic appointments and in his overarching approach, as we've seen it so far, rejoining the Paris Climate Accords, the World Health Organization, and other international organizations, his approach is pretty familiar.
I think that's right. Look, you know, events often shape an administration's foreign policy far more so than they're willing to acknowledge. In fact, it's not a good guide often to look at what candidates said on the campaign trail about their foreign policy versus what it actually turns out to be. And that's been true for Democrats and Republicans. Biden is coming in at a time of great national, but also international crisis. And so I think that's where you're going to see the early efforts and therefore the early tone of this U.S. return to multilateralism in the world. So you're going to see the Biden team probably emphasize non-traditional foreign policy issues like public health because of the pandemic. I think, you know, you'll see them perhaps join this international effort to distribute the coronavirus vaccines to poor countries around the world. That's something that the Trump administration boycotted, you know, but I think along with rejoining the WHO, you may see that as a focus of Biden diplomacy in the short term. You may see more collective efforts on dealing with the economic fallout from the pandemic. Right now, we've been very, very inward looking, not only because of the election, but also because the Trump administration has so failed to get the pandemic under control. So I think it might be a more outward looking time once, and let's hope and knock wood that we manage to get the virus under control here more domestically.
And maybe you can tell us a little bit about these early choices for Biden's foreign policy team. You must know most of them. Anthony Blinken as Secretary of State, Jake Sullivan as National Security Advisor, John Kerry as Special Envoy on the Climate, Avril Haines as Director of National Intelligence. Maybe just jump in and tell us about one or two of them.
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. I mean, you know, look, these are longtime Washington hands. I've known, you know, Tony Blinken since the Clinton administration when he was, you know, a young aide on the National Security Council. Jake Sullivan was Hillary Clinton's right hand person at the State Department, and he was at Clinton's side throughout the 2016 campaign, a key advisor on both domestic and international policy issues. And, you know, I think in particular for Jake, it will be very interesting to see what are the real lessons that he takes away from that Clinton defeat and the rise of Donald Trump, and what is the interconnection between the domestic discontent with globalization and with foreign policy that may have helped to fuel Trumpism. So I'm very interested to see how, if at all, does that translate into a different kind of foreign policy? Because, of course, Biden, in his public speeches, offers a kind of gauzy nostalgia for a time when America stood tall on the world stage, a kind of liberal internationalism with America permanently at the head of the table, but, you know, somehow not militaristic either. I think these are a pragmatic generation, but they're also absolutely representative of the pre-existing Washington consensus, the post-Cold War Washington consensus. That is what Jake Sullivan and Tony Blinken and the others are a product of.
So what should we know about Avril Haines?
Well, I mean, you know, she is going to be the first woman to have this job of Director of National Intelligence since the position was created in the aftermath of the September 11th attacks. She is very highly regarded veteran of the Obama administration, as I mentioned. I think she has, in many ways, one of the tougher jobs, right? Because Trump has launched this sort of sustained four-year attack on the credibility of the American intelligence community and its many different agencies, which are rolled up under the Directorate of National Intelligence. So she has a super hard job right now of restoring the independence and credibility of this. But I would also point out that Avril Haines was also involved in working at this outside consulting firm, West Exec Advisors, that Tony Blinken was one of the founders of. So they literally have been working together in the private sector as well as in their previous public sector experience.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit NewYorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
So Biden, as you just touched on above, is already facing his first crisis. Trump pulled out of the Iran nuclear deal, as we know, in 2018, and took a hardline approach that was endorsed by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Last week, Iran's top nuclear scientist was assassinated, almost certainly by Israel. Iran has threatened retaliation. How will this affect Biden's plan to return to the deal?
Well, it's very interesting. That was a lot of the tone of the immediate commentary by those who follow this closely, was to suggest that this was an effort by Netanyahu, almost certainly in league with the Trump administration, who've been his close partners for the last 4 years, to perhaps box in Biden and to make it harder for him to return to the Iran deal, to make diplomacy harder, to make the Iranian hardliners essentially empowered at the expense of those who would seek to negotiate with Biden. Right now, I think the immediate worry is that we're not done with the crisis, right? So rather than jump ahead to the question of what diplomacy Biden can engage in on January 21st, I think a lot of people here in Washington are still very worried about the next 48 days, because what kind of Iranian retaliation, if any? I think one concern I've heard voiced from senior U.S. national security officials is, you know, what if there is some kind of an attack on American interests in Iraq that come from Iranian proxies? What if Trump then is forced or wants to retaliate in a big way and we lead to some kind of escalating conflict? I would remind you that we've actually seen versions of this happening before, where Netanyahu, looking at an unfavorable, from his point of view, change of administration, the U.S. has sought to create new facts on the ground in the Middle East. This literally happened in the interregnum between the Bush administration and the incoming Obama administration. Netanyahu actually started a brief war in Gaza because he was so concerned that the new Obama administration would be unfavorable to him. And so I think we're not out of this current crisis yet, whatever it's going to be. And so it's a little bit hard to make forecasts, given we could see additional problems and conflicts arising between now and January 20th.
And is it even possible to just return to the Iran nuclear deal?
Well, that's a good question. In theory, it is, because the Iranians and the other parties to the deal, which again was a UN brokered agreement, those other parties have never exited the deal. So the deal still exists. So technically, it is certainly possible. But the question might be, what does it mean? And remember, there have also been 4 years worth of other developments on the ground in the Middle East. The recent alignment brokered by the Trump administration to have official recognition of Israel by some of Iran's biggest enemies and adversaries in the Middle East, the United Arab Emirates. There's a possibility that Saudi Arabia may soon recognize Israel as well, and perhaps Qatar, Bahrain. Does this mean that the politics are harder to rejoin the Iran deal? What about the non-nuclear military picture in the Middle East? I read a very smart and provocative piece the other day pointing out that the real threat to Israel might not be from a theoretical Iranian nuclear weapons, which Iran, let's hope, is very, very unlikely ever to use, but from the actual development of far more sophisticated drone and missile technology in the last 4 years that makes Israel a much more serious threat from Iran than it had been 4 years ago.
And what was what was going on last week when Netanyahu secretly met with Saudi Arabian Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman? Pompeo, as I recall, was present. What do we know about that meeting?
Well, look, there's been a full court press by the Trump administration in its waning days to get as many Arab partners as possible to sign on to what they call the Abraham Accords and this new recognition by Arab states of Israel, which is an unprecedented step and a significant change in the region that up until now was blocked by the fact that there was no resolution between Israel and the Palestinians. But, the Trump administration has found a way forward, at least with countries like the Emirates and Bahrain. They really, really want Saudi Arabia. That's the biggest Sunni power in the region. They really want Saudi Arabia to sign on. It appears, based on the reports that I've read out of that meeting, that the Saudis are holding off for now. Perhaps that's something they want to offer the new Biden administration. They recognize that they're going to have some real diplomacy to do because they are seen as having worked so closely in league with the outgoing Trump administration. They understand there's going to be a real skepticism perhaps on the part of the new Biden team. So it looks like certainly Netanyahu and Pompeo were trying to convince the Saudis to join in recognizing Israel.
And what about Russia? Talk to us a little bit about that. Trump has turned a completely blind eye to Putin's malfeasance on everything from Russian interference in the 2016 U.S. election to the poisoning of Alexei Navalny and the ongoing conflict in eastern Ukraine.
Well, that's right. There will be an early test of what kind of Russia policy Biden is going to have in February, which is when there's going to be the expiration of the New START treaty. That essentially is the final remaining shred of the arms control umbrella that had bound the Soviet Union and then subsequently Russia and the United States in terms of their own nuclear arsenals. And that was negotiated by the Obama administration. It's set to expire in February. The Russians have said they want to extend it. So right away, you're going to have an early test of can Biden and his new team work with the Russians and come up with either an extension or just a long-term renewal of this New START treaty. And I think that's going to tell us a lot about what kind of relationship the two countries have.
And let's talk about China for a second. Every president from Nixon to Obama encouraged China's economic rise, but that era seems to be over. I think you've said that the adversarial competition between the U.S. and China could force Biden to prepare for a Cold War-style conflict.
That has been one of the more striking shifts in opinion among foreign policy specialists in both parties in the last 4 years, a recognition by Democrats as well as Republicans that as Jake Sullivan, the new national security advisor, wrote in a piece in Foreign Affairs just a year ago, that the era of strategic engagement has come to an unceremonious close. We've recognized more or less across the board that policy, to the extent it ever worked at all, is no longer a viable one, given China's much more muscular assertion of both economic and military power under Xi Jinping. Now, the question is, does that mean in a practical sense from the new Biden administration? And there, I think it's much less clear. Obviously, Biden comes into office much more skeptical of the trade wars and tariffs that Donald Trump has used essentially as his main China policy vehicles. Trump has not expressed much interest in the security and military piece of this, even at the same time as China has become much more threatening and assertive in the South China Sea, advancing its territorial claims or in some of its rhetoric rhetoric toward Taiwan. Trump really has not engaged with that so much, even though he's had a fairly hawkish administration under him, both at the Pentagon and his Republican allies on Capitol Hill. So I would imagine you will see a lot more talk about human rights and Western-style values from Joe Biden than you ever heard from Donald Trump. You know, I think he'll talk a lot about Hong Kong and the dismantling of Hong Kong's democratic institutions. But I'm not yet sure what beyond that you'll hear from the Biden administration.
Trump last month ordered a troop drawdown in Afghanistan and Iraq. But Biden is inevitably going to get mired once again in these wars. It seems that the stakes in Afghanistan are particularly high as Taliban attacks have intensified, even while peace talks continue. What is Biden? I haven't really noticed what Biden has been saying about the war in Afghanistan. I remember he was a skeptic of the troop surge during the Obama era.
Well, that's exactly right. You know, I talked with one Republican former Pentagon official the other day who said that, you know, this might be one area where Trump has, in his own divisive way, done a very big favor to Joe Biden. And I think that's part of the reason why you haven't heard a lot from Biden or his new team about these moves on Afghanistan. Biden, as you pointed out, was definitely much more skeptical, even in the Obama administration, of a continued large presence in Afghanistan and favored essentially a more modest counterterrorism focused mission there. So, you know, the question really is whether events are going to conspire against him in this case. And unfortunately, many experts on South Asia, people who followed it for years, are so worried about exactly that kind of a scenario. And they look back to when America withdrew its gaze from Pakistan and Afghanistan in the early 1990s. You know, to many people, the lesson they took away from that was that this created the security vacuum and the conditions that enabled the Taliban to rise to power, that enabled the Taliban to give safe haven and sanctuary to al-Qaeda. And so, you know, lots of people just, you know, praying that this is not a terrible case of history repeating itself in terms of how and when the U.S. carries out this exit from the region.
We haven't really touched on another factor in U.S. foreign policy, which is Congress. We don't know yet which party will control the Senate in January when Biden's sworn in. He is a former chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and his vice president, Kamala Harris, currently serves on the Senate Intelligence Committee. Both know Congress quite well, both see themselves as dealmakers, willing to reach across the aisle. Still, given what we know about Republicans in Congress and the toxic relationship between the two sides right now, is there a sense that there will be cooperation with Biden on international issues?
Well, look, obviously the president has more leeway on international issues than on certain domestic issues. We have imbue a lot of executive authority in the president when it comes to national security. Also, this is an area where Senate Republicans, even though they weren't necessarily always so vocal, where they probably differed more than any other with Donald Trump, who at times had his own foreign policy that was at odds not only with parts of his administration, but also with much of his party. So I think that to the extent Biden is leaning in toward alliances, leaning back into NATO, leaning back into cooperative security efforts with European allies, you're going to have Republicans welcoming that to the extent that he is having a more muscular policy toward Russia, or at least embracing his own administration's policy toward Russia. Republicans on the Hill are certainly not going to be opposed to that. So, you know, this might be an area where they have something in common, actually, at least in the short term. I think that, you know, what we're going to see in the beginning of the Biden administration, just to circle back to the beginning here, is not going to be a lot about Russia. It might not even be a lot about China. It's going to be a lot about public health and the coronavirus vaccine and working together, rejoining international institutions. And it's going to be about climate change. That's an area where Republicans, you know, continue to be dissenters, continue to strongly not want to be part of global efforts. And so that could be a point of friction from day one with the new administration.
Thanks so much, Susan. Illuminating as always.
Well, thank you, Dorothy. It's great to be with you.
C Susan B. Glasser is a staff writer at The New Yorker, where she has been writing a weekly column on life in Trump's Washington, and the co-author of a new book, The Man Who Ran Washington, The Life and Times of James A. Baker III. This has been The Political Scene. You can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app, and find more political analysis and commentary on newyorker.com. Feel free to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Our theme music is by Russell Gillespie. This program was produced by Alex Barron and Kylie Warner for newyorker.com. I'm Dorothy Wickenden.